This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Der Kick der Woche mit warmen Looks für kalte Tage.
So viel mehr Wohlfühlmode.
Mit Damenhausslipper je 5,99 Euro.
Und so viel mehr für die Piste.
Mit Kinder-Skijacken oder Hosen ab 12,99 Euro. Nur jetzt und nur bei Kick. Mehr als du denkst.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The virtual space where you, me, the top experts, 28 minutes and a big issue of the day get together. Today, Afghan refugees. The debacle in Afghanistan has displaced millions internally and hundreds of thousands more may be looking to leave the country. Where will they go? And how far will we in Britain and Europe be willing to help them? Up to 500,000 Afghans could leave their country by the end of the year, a UN refugee agency has warned. Some will move to neighbouring countries, already accommodating large numbers of refugees. Others will travel thousands of miles to all parts of the globe in the hope of forging a better life. So far, the West has offered them warm words. But what will happen to these people in practice? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we need to understand the likely scale of the Afghan refugee problem. To assess that, I have with me Camille Lecouz, policy analyst at the Migration Policy Institute, and Michael Semple, professor at the Mitchell Institute for Global Peace, Security and Justice at Queen's University Belfast, and expert on Afghanistan. Camille Lecouz, can I start by asking you what we actually know about the scale of the refugee crisis in Afghanistan, how many people have left, and then to try and guess how many more will try to leave?
So what we know for now is that about 500,000 people have been displaced within the country, leading to a total of 4 million internally displaced persons in Afghanistan. Now for people who are outside Afghanistan or who may leave, the projection of the UN High Commission for Refugee, UNHCR, is that in the worst case scenario, about 500,000 people may leave to, you know, neighboring country by the end of the year. That is about 300,000 to Pakistan, 150,000 to Iran, and then to the other countries in the north of Afghanistan.
Okay, so that's the worst case scenario. I'm going to ask you a really tricky question now. What does the worst case scenario depend upon?
So there are many questions as to what the new regime in Afghanistan is going to look like, what rules the Taliban are going to enforce within the countries, but also beyond that, what's going to be the relationship between the Taliban regime and the rest of the world? We know a number of countries have already suspended development cooperation with Afghanistan. And so there are discussions now ongoing on how are we going to deliver humanitarian assistance that's direly needed in the country. And then more broadly, development. So that is more structural aid and that the country really rely on. So depending on all of this discussion, I think we'll see people wanting to leave. There are different kind of people who are going to leave. I think we're seeing people, as we've seen with the evacuation, people who've been associated with international presence, who've supported foreign troops, but also work with international NGOs, international organizations. Then we also have this middle class that is not necessarily directly affiliated with internationals, but, you know, has flourished in the past years, has had a business. And these are people who had saving in the local currency and who may have lost all of this in the past few weeks.
Michael Semple, what's your estimate?
I think my first answer is it depends on how things play out. Certainly, there is a real risk of a large exodus of refugees over the next year or so, which could be numbered, you know, in the millions, as in, you know, a million upwards. We do not have a massive armed conflict at the moment, but we do have the kind of conditions in terms of a pretty authoritarian government with no regard for the welfare of the population and economic collapse and the prospect of possible future conflict. All of those add up to the possibility of flow of a million or more. We do not have that flow at the moment, but it's certainly a scenario that we should be ready for.
Is it useful, Camille, to look at what's happened in recent history? I mean, how far could we compare what might happen with Afghanistan with what we saw coming out of Syria in 2015?
I think first we should compare the numbers. And we know, it's, you know, with the Syrian crisis, for instance, we've had 1.2 million people traveling to Europe in just a few months in 2015. But then there was this total of 6.8 million refugees, mainly, you know, in Turkey, which is hosting 3.6 million refugees, but also in Jordan and Lebanon. So, you know, in comparison, if we, again, stick to this UNHCR projection of the worst case scenario till the end of the year of 500,000, number seems to be smaller. From Europe's perspective, the crisis is also further away because, as we know, most refugees are likely to stay in Pakistan and Iran, which are countries that do not have a direct border with Europe and where, you know, Afghan refugees have been hosted for over 40 years.
Michael, the same broad question to you, comparing what's happening now and what might happen with Syria.
I think that one of the key comparisons with Syria is that Afghan refugees draw upon networks which can help move them across the region. These are largely human smuggling networks and also networks linking Afghan communities. And this is where I think that we have to see that Afghanistan and the intention of Afghan refugees or migrants has changed relative to previous flows from Afghanistan. And so I think that we should be ready for the kind of mass move and people focused on getting to Europe, a la Syria 2015, rather than previous mass migrations from Afghanistan. Yes, Afghanistan has borders with Iran and Pakistan, and historically, large numbers of Afghans have settled in those two countries. But the one of the ways in which Afghanistan has changed over the past 20 years is that, in a sense, all Afghans know their way to Europe now in a way that they couldn't even imagine 20 years ago.
Well, that's very interesting. And we'll come on to the ramifications of some of that in a moment. But Michael, for the moment, which Afghans are trying to leave now? And I presume it's not just those who are fearful because they had helped coalition forces.
I think that in the coming weeks, the pattern of exodus will become clearer because we had this short-term focus on the airlift organized by the US and its allies, which did focus on those who had worked with the coalition, including people who'd been working with the military and even people who'd been just working with NGOs. As that airlift has now sort of closed down and we're getting into the next phase, I think we'll see, first of all, people who have worked with the collapsed Afghan government. Many of those people, you know, now are in the country and trying to get out. And we're trying to work out just how far down in their hierarchy does that go. We heard before the collapse President Biden talk about the 300,000 plus members of the security forces that he was counting on to defend the Kabul government. Well, they didn't defend the Kabul government, but the Taliban have subsequently been going around and selectively have been grabbing members of the security forces, beating them up and telling them they'll be subject to punishment. And in some cases, they have been summarily executing them. Potentially, you have 300,000 former members of the security forces. But there are also people who have been civilians and simply reckon that they cannot cope under this new regime because their livelihoods have collapsed.
Camille, Michael talked about the different orientation of Afghan refugees now, potentially to Afghan refugees in the past. What's your understanding of where refugees are likely to try and go? And also, based on that, what's your understanding of what the international community's stance on dealing with those movements is?
We've had in the past few weeks this discussion in Europe about a pending crisis, a renewal of the crisis that happened in 2015-16. I think now it's too early to say, and we should remind ourselves that the journey from Pakistan, Iran to Europe is a long journey. It's expensive. It's dangerous. And as we've seen in the past few weeks, Turkey, you know, is also finalizing a wall at the border with Iran. It's becoming much more difficult to cross. And Turkey, I believe, is also not so keen on having these people transit through its territory. So for now, you know, it's too early to say whether people will ultimately try to come to Europe. But what is sure is that Europe should prepare for, you know, this arrival, and should this arrival happen, have all the mechanism in place on the ground to process this asylum claim.
Michael, responding to what Camille said, are you looking at it in the same way?
Yes, but I'm looking particularly at the response inside Afghanistan and the dilemmas that this poses for the international actors, EU, US, UK. One of the best ways to ensure that there is a minimal flow of refugees outside of Afghanistan is to ensure that the country becomes functional again. But for that, countries now have to work out how they deal with the de facto authorities which the Taliban have imposed.
Immense dilemmas, and some of them depend upon variables which the international community can't control. And speaking of that, Camille, what do you see as the attitude of Iran and Pakistan, the immediate neighbours, to dealing with the refugee problem, which they're already beginning to have and which presumably could get a lot greater?
Absolutely. And these two countries have already signaled that, you know, they've done their share and they will need more support in the coming week, in the coming months, and probably coming years. They will need development assistance, but also this idea that maybe refugee will be, you know, would be put in camps in the border region, which, as we know, is not a way that's conducive for the social and economic inclusion of this population, and often leads people to stay in this camp for decades. And so I think a discussion that's going to be very difficult and very sensitive for the international community to have with these two countries is, can we work to grant more rights to these people, to grant them full refugee status so that they have access to public services, but also to the right to work? And we know this is always a very sensitive question. And I think what we're going to see is Iran and Pakistan looking very closely at what European, but also American leaders say in terms of what they are going to do, how they're going to demonstrate solidarity.
Michael Semple and Camille Cuz. Making it clear that the size of any refugee problem depends on a series of factors, many of which are very hard to predict, but it could be pretty significant. So now I want to know how well set up we in Britain are to cope. Helping us with that, we have Peter Walsh, researcher in migration at the Migration Observatory, and Dominic Casciani, the BBC's home and legal correspondent. Dominic, clearly the government is aware that something is coming, it's already begun, and they're taking it seriously, and they've appointed this Afghan resettlement minister in Victoria Atkins. What has she said so far?
Well, she hasn't said a great deal so far, I think partly because within Whitehall, from my understanding, there are so many moving parts trying to work out how on earth they're going to deal with the incoming refugees from Afghanistan. I don't think they're entirely sure exactly what the final policies are, left, right and centre, other than a few headlines. I think it perhaps may make sense if I talk you through some of what we definitely know for sure. So of the 15,000 who have been brought from Afghanistan to the UK since this crisis really took off, 8,000 of those are definitely Afghans under the Afghan Relocations and Assistance Policy. So this is the key policy for bringing in Afghans who are closely linked to the UK state, you know, translators, interpreters, people who worked at the embassy, things like that. So we know 8,000 are definitely Afghans. We don't know how many of the remaining 7,000 are Afghans. Okay, it's a little bit confusing at the moment. So we know 15,000 been brought in, 8,000 are definitely Afghans. We're not quite sure about the other 7,000. Some of them may be dual British Afghan nationals. Some of them are British staff. It's a little bit confusing. On top of that, we don't know what the government's going to do about a second scheme it's setting up, which is called the Afghan Citizens Resettlement Scheme, which plans to bring in about 5,000 people a year, up to a max of 20,000. That's the kind of aim. We don't know how that's going to work yet, because quite obviously at the moment they can't bring anybody out of Afghanistan because we have no presence there anymore and Kabul airport is shut. So things are a little bit confusing on the figures.
Peter, we've got the 8,000, we've got the 5,000 a year rising up to 20,000. How does that compare with previous schemes, say the numbers that Britain took from Syria?
Yeah, so the numbers are broadly comparable with the Syrian refugee resettlement scheme, which aimed to resettle 20,000 in 5 years. And ultimately, it passed that threshold after 7 years, taking into account that there was a hiatus due to COVID last year. We don't know exactly how the Afghan citizens resettlement scheme is going to be designed, but people tend to be working on the assumption that it's going to be modelled on the Syrian scheme. And certainly the numbers that have been committed reflect that.
OK. What calculation about the numbers of people who might want to come here does the 5,000 a year rising to 20,000 a year relate to?
It's not clear at all. There's been no rationale provided for that specific number, which I'm sure to some extent is arbitrary, except to say that 5,000 a year is about what we can effectively manage. But as far as I can see, that's the only statement that's been provided with regard to the specific numbers that have been chosen.
So, Peter, one of the big questions which the listener will have in their minds is, what is the difference between resettlement, which is one of the terms that we've used, and asylum?
Yes, and it's very important to understand the difference. So what we might call the normal asylum process, that involves making an asylum application. But to claim asylum in the UK, a person must first arrive in the UK. You can't apply abroad at a British consulate or embassy, and there's no visa for the specific purpose of seeking asylum in the UK. So what does that mean? It means that to claim asylum, a person must first reach the UK, either clandestinely, such as by small boat or stowing away on a lorry, or on a visa for some other purpose, and then claim asylum on arrival. And then once they've claimed asylum, they have to wait for a decision on their claim, which in most cases, in 80% of cases, that takes more than 6 months. Now, with resettlement, there is no application process. Instead, people are selected by the UN and transferred, usually from refugee camps, to participate in countries like the UK. And it's that resettlement process that's been likened to a scene in Toy Story in the first movie, where Buzz Lightyear finds himself with a collection of other toys in an amusement arcade grabber machine, in the one where children manipulate a claw to grab a prize. And the toys in this machine, they view the claw as akin to a god, which selects a chosen one to travel to a better place. And that's really what refugee resettlement is like, because it's a lottery and ultimately a very small share, less than 1% of refugees are selected by the UN for resettlement.
It's quite obvious to me, and I will be to listeners, that these numbers don't quite add up. In other words, we say 8,000 people who were somehow linked to the British government, 5,000 per year, making up 20,000 who will be part of a resettlement scheme. And then, of course, the numbers who will seek to come here are much greater. And the obvious point really is that if they don't have a route to get here under one of those schemes, many of them will try to get here by some other method, Peter.
Yes, that's right. And historically, we've seen that that's what Afghans have done. So since the year 2000, we've actually offered protection to 29,000 Afghans who claimed asylum through the normal asylum process. Now, that was mostly in the early 2000s in response to the conflict in Afghanistan. And that is the most common nationality to whom we've granted asylum.
Where does this, in your opinion, leave the government's new asylum legislation, which was billed as being very draconian and meaning that people who came by illegal routes, and as you pointed out, most routes are likely to be illegal, could actually be prosecuted and jailed.
The main proposal in the new Nationality and Borders Bill that's relevant here is the plan to penalise asylum seekers who satisfy two criteria, so who entered illegally, such as by small boat or lorry, and from a country considered by the UK government to be safe, such as France. And the proposal is that if a person enters in that way, the government will try to make them inadmissible to the asylum system and try to remove them. The only problem is it's unlikely to be able to remove them because we're no longer a part of the mechanism that allowed that. We're no longer a part of the EU and the Dublin III regulation. And so if the government can't remove these asylum claimants, which is fairly likely, they will hear the claim. But even if they agree that the person is a genuine refugee, they'll still try to remove them. And there is an article in the Refugee Convention that explicitly states that you're not allowed to penalise asylum seekers on account of illegal entry or presence. And the UN Refugee Agency has said quite plainly that the proposals are not consistent with the convention. So we can expect that policy to be challenged in the courts should it make its way onto the statute book.
Dominic, as far as you know, is the government aware of the potential problem for their new legislation provided by this events coming out of Afghanistan?
I think they're almost certainly aware of the problem. How they're going to deal with it and deal with the criticisms they're going to face is another question. When we were at Heathrow last week seeing refugees arrive on these flights and getting a genuinely warm welcome from very serious-minded and caring officials, I mean, it was quite moving to see it actually happen. The amount of effort was put in to actually welcome these people and put their minds at ease when they were safe in the UK. One of the things we were asking the senior officials who were there, including the Home Secretary, was what are you going to do if people start arriving through these unofficial routes? Yeah, how are you going to manage them? And we didn't really get a clear answer on that. And I think this is because there is this issue here now for the government, because on the one hand, it wants to be seen to be reforming the asylum system to minimise crossings because of, you know, all the obvious things we know about the links to smuggling and criminality and the dangers involved, and also for the fact that the UK believes these people should be claiming asylum elsewhere in Europe. On the one hand, you've got that going on and those people being treated differently. But on the other, we're now saying, well, anyone arriving from Afghanistan through the official schemes is richly deserving in protection. You've got a disconnect going on there. That is only going to build over time. And I'll tell you where this is also going to build is also actually in the resourcing around local authorities. You've got a big, big problem there as well with local authorities saying, well, hang on a second, we need more money on both sides of the equation for both the refugee settlement through the official schemes, but also the asylum seekers we're dealing with at the same time.
Peter, let's go directly to that point, which is that indeed this week, some local councils have been saying, we're going to do it or we're doing it, but the other councils aren't and it's not fair. And quite a lot of councils have not been saying anything at all. Are local authorities actually equipped to deal with what's coming?
It's not clear, largely because there's still so much uncertainty, including on the part of local councils, about how exactly the Afghan resettlement programme will work. But if we operate on the assumption that it's going to be modelled on the Syrian resettlement programme, then we can expect, and I think we've already seen this, a large number of local authorities to take part. Most of them still have the infrastructure in place from the Syrian scheme. And although it's true that that programme was not without its wrinkles at the local council level, it generally operated, I think, successfully. It's agreed to have been well managed. Councils coped fairly well. And in general, they found that they received sufficient government funding. So it will depend, of course, on the precise design of the programme. But if it's similar to the Syrian programme, then I think there is some confidence among local councils in general that they will be able to cope.
Dominic, I have two questions for you arising from this. The first one is that, of course, we've seen that the numbers actually could be considerably greater than those for councils. The second thing is the assumption that you should just take a few asylum seekers and give them to all councils around the country. There are some problems with that, don't you think?
Let me give an example of how integration works in practice and why you have to think very carefully about where you place asylum seekers and refugees as part of that process. If you spread all of the incoming Afghan refugees equally across the country, you'd have very, very small little pockets, you know, one or two families here or there per town. Now, all the academic evidence and everything about actually how people kind of build capacity, to use the jargon, you know, and build new communities, show that you actually need to have larger communities because people get isolated. You know, it's very, very difficult for them to rebuild their lives if they haven't got someone else they can effectively lean on. And so where you build larger communities, it helps people settle. And that's one of the reasons why, for instance, the Ugandan Asians were ultimately relatively successful as incoming refugees because they formed a large pocket, a large community in the East Midlands around Leicester so they could support each other. All the evidence seems to show that policy works where you bring people together. So if you look at where people have been housed at the moment, you've got to take that into account. It also helps with spending. So if you look at schools, the government has committed about £12 million extra at the moment for school places for the incoming Afghans under the ARAP scheme. Now, that sounds like a lot of money, but in practice, if you average it out over all the local authorities who may be currently involved, it works out at basically less than two primary school teachers per local authority. And you think, well, that's not very much when you're dealing with hundreds of Afghani kids who can't speak English. But in practice, it could arguably be enough because of the economies of scale if they're moving into an area that's already used to teaching children who have English as a second language and need to be brought on fairly rapidly. So there is a balancing exercise there. The third issue, though, in this, and I think this is the one which actually poses the greatest questions for Whitehall and for local authorities, is the question of integration with the settled community. And we've seen down the years where that's badly managed, that it can lead to local tensions rising, particularly around things like racism or perceptions of competition for housing and jobs as a separate issue. I remember a big issue in Sunderland about 15 years ago where a lot of Iranians were moved in as part of the asylum system. They were put in very, very poor housing, but there was a local perception these people had a preference and tensions rose locally. And a lot of these Iranians struggled to integrate as a result.
Peter, that's right, isn't it? I mean, it's the managing of such perceptions which is really tricky. The classic, it's already been raised. I've seen it already once this week. They will get on the housing lists in front of people who are currently waiting, already raised.
Yeah, there is the question of housing sustainability as well with the resettlement, which is a little bit different to the normal asylum system where people are dispersed around the country, but because it's contracted out to private firms, they tend to accumulate in areas where housing is less expensive. With resettlement, people have been dispersed around the country much more spread out, and that includes to wealthy areas, and the sustainability of that long term is a big question mark over the Afghan resettlement scheme, because local authorities, they have to top up housing costs to move people. And this feeds, of course, into the broader integration question. Now, that was a vital issue with the Syrian scheme, because the UK did not have then and does not have now a UK-wide strategy for integration. It doesn't have a nationwide strategy for English language learning. And so there are these wider structural issues that will be very important to be addressed for the successful functioning of the Afghan scheme, because it's much more expensive to design bespoke packages for families in local communities to ensure that they're properly catered for, rather than it is to just solve these problems nationwide more structurally.
Peter Walsh there with Dominic Kesciani. And I have to say, by way of conclusion, that it's hard not to see many more Afghans than are officially envisaged seeking to come to Britain, and it's not clear that we're prepared to deal with that reality. My thanks to Camilla Kurz, Michael Semple, Dominic Kesciani and Peter Walsh. We'll be back at the same time next week.
You've been listening to The Briefing Room with David Aronovich. The producers were me, Ben Carter, Kirstine Knight and Sharon Hemans. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editors were Alison G and Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. Recently we've asked, who's supporting the Taliban? What's next for Joe Biden's foreign policy? And is HS2 on track? And if you'd like to hear more about how refugees settle in new homes, you might like to check out another BBC podcast, People Fixing the World. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts and search for the edition called How Five Friends Can Change a Refugee's Life.
Stopping climate change is a tough job, but we know the people who can do it.
I think I'm generally just a very impatient person.
39 Ways to Save the Planet is the podcast from BBC Radio 4 that meets the brightest brains with the best ideas to cut carbon.
Everyone thought he was mad. Now others are doing it. They accept he's a visionary.
From carbon-sucking building materials...
It will be very nice to say, oh, my house is made of banana peel. Nothing wrong in that.
To solar water heaters in Rwanda.
The cold water comes in at the bottom, and then hot water comes out at the top. It's as simple as that.
The ideas are out there, so join me, Tom Heap, and let's get on with it. Subscribe to 39 Ways to Save the Planet on BBC Sounds.
Innovation bringt die Welt seit jeher voran, doch sie birgt auch Risiken. In einer Zeit, in der die Welt neue Energielösungen benötigt, stellt sich AXA XL den Risiken. Als einer der führenden globalen Versicherer setzen wir ständig neue Maßstäbe, um die Energiewende zu beschleunigen.
AXA XL. Risiken eingehen für eine Zukunft voller Möglichkeiten. Diese Anzeige stellt weder ein Angebot oder eine Aufforderung dar, noch ist sie eine Beschreibung von Produkten oder Dienstleistungen von AXA XL.